All right, good morning, everybody. It is Tuesday morning, April 5th, 11:15, and this is Chem 12A. So last time we were doing chapter 6 in the energy chapter, and this is both energy and mechanisms. And so this next part here, we pick up where we left off. We were looking at Hammond postulate. We've sort of finished with the energy diagrams, and the next thing that we're going to pick up on here is reaction mechanisms. So reaction mechanisms are really, these are reaction mechanisms, not entire reactions, but reaction mechanism steps, really. And before we even get into the steps, we need to define a few terms, nucleophile and electrophile. Let's start with nucleophiles. We tend to couch everything within a language that is either nucleophile, nucleophilic, electrophile, electrophilic. And these terms we use constantly, nucleophilic attack, nucleophiles, electrophiles. We use them to refer to species that have certain properties. So a nucleophile is something that is electron rich. This is an electron rich species. And that means that it has certain types of properties, certain types of functional groups, which are electron rich functional groups. These are also species that are looking for a partner to react with, and they're looking for either a positive species, a cation, or they're looking for a partial positive, which we don't have a name for yet, but that's going to be our electrophile. And so they're looking for either a full positive or a partial positive charge to react with. These can be things that are electron rich that have negative charges. So we can say an oxide anion. These can be things that have just lone pairs, such as an alcohol. These can be things that have pi bonds, pi electrons. So in each case here, what we're looking at is we're focusing in on the electron-rich nature of this species. And these are things that are called nucleophiles. The other term that I said was electrophile. The electrophile is something that that is an electron poor species. As an electron poor species, this is looking for either a full negative, an anion, or a partial minus to react with. And so these things are things like protons are a good example of an electrophile. We can do carbocations. These can be things with partial positive charge, such as carbonyls, where the oxygen is partial minus and the carbonyl carbon is partial positive. These can be things that have strongly electronegative elements or weakly electronegative elements that leave a partial positive charge on the carbon. And so in each one of these cases, what we're seeing here is that the centers that we're looking at that are either partially positive or fully positively charged, these are things which are electrophiles. And we'll highlight these steps and we'll put names to each one of these things as we look at them. So the next thing that we need to look at after we define these terms of nucleophile and electrophile are some common mechanistic steps. Arrow pushing is what we'll call it. arrow pushing is sort of the common phrase that's used. You got to do your arrow pushing. We're looking at how the electrons flow. So just as a reminder, when we're looking at arrow pushing, we're always looking at the source of the electrons as the beginning part of the arrow, the curved arrow, and then where the electrons are going to. So the arrows always start from either the negative charge and go to its next location, or start at the lone pairs and go to its next location. So each one of these steps, nucleophilic attack, each one of these steps has a name and can be demonstrated by many different arrow pushing steps. So we can look at nucleophilic attack in a number of different contexts. We can have a bromide reacting with a carbocation. In this case, the electrons are flowing from the negative charge to the positive charge. When they come together, they make a new carbon bromide bond. And I'll do it this way. So here's the bromide attached to the carbon, and the carbon changes hybridization and becomes tetrahedral in the process. We can look at something like an alcohol reacting with a protonated carbonyl. In this case, the oxygen bears a positive, but there is a partial positive, which is at the carbonyl carbon here. And sometimes what people will do will show the resonance and show the positive charge on the carbon and then attack. But just as easily, what we can do is we can use the lone pairs of electrons to attack that carbon. This bond will break and shift up onto the oxygen. The result of that is that we make a new oxygen carbon bond. The carbon again becomes tetrahedral. And the positive charge now resides on the oxygen that attacked. We have a lone pair of electrons there, and we have two lone pairs of electrons on that guy. So I'll track them that way. I think what I'd like to do is I'd like to change this arrow too to red. I'll just keep the color coding consistent. And we try to do curved arrows as much as possible rather than straight arrows. So we try to put a little bit of curve into each one of those arrows. And we can now go through, when we highlight each one of these things, we can now go through and we can put names to each one of them. For instance, the bromide is the nucleophile. And the carbocation is the electrophile. Here, the methanol or ethanol, actually ethanol in this case, is the nucleophile. And the protonated carbonyl, the protonated acetone, is the electrophile. And if you look at it, you notice that the nucleophile is always the thing that is using its electrons to make the bond with the electrophile. In doing so, the form of the arrow shows that the nucleophile is attacking, making the bond with the electrophile. And so that's where this name comes from, nucleophilic attack, is that the nucleophile is actively using its electrons in order to bond with the electrophile. We can do one more. I'll do another step here. Let's do a alkene reacting, in this case, with hydrobromic acid. In this one, the bond breaks here, and the electrons take the proton. And this bond breaks, and the electrons go back to the bromide. The result is that I get a bromine with a negative charge. Now with four lone pairs, it had three. That bond became the fourth lone pair. And the result of the other component is that the proton is picked up and the carbon becomes positively charged. Let's say that there are two additional protons that are out here, and that will allow me to track those protons. And I'll make sure that I recognize that these were my existing protons and where that proton went that I picked up and the resulting positive charge. As such, this is my nucleophile. The alkene is the nucleophile and the acid is the electrophile. Okay, next up, we have loss of leaving group. Loss of leaving group is where something gets kicked out, is the easiest way to recognize it. We can show a group here that perhaps has a positive charge on it, an oxonium ion. And loss of a leaving group is where a bond breaks and a group dissociates and leaves. This leaves behind a carbocation, and the leaving group will either leave as being neutral, or sometimes it can leave with a charge on it. And so the group here, the way that I refer to this is that this group is the leaving group. We can do another one. And you'll see that these have no common structural themes, really, in that the molecules can look extremely diverse. The leaving groups can look extremely diverse. There are many different ways in which this these molecules can look, which makes it hard to recognize a lot of times. And so the recognition is going to become, or is going to come from observing a lot of different patterns and watching for the patterns. Okay, in this case, the anion, the carbanion, the negative charge pushes in to make a new carbon-carbon bond, but carbon can only maintain four bonds at a time. If I just push those in, I'm going to get five bonds to this central carbon. Carbon can't maintain five bonds, something has to leave. The bromide becomes the leaving group. That's going to maintain my four bonds to carbon. So I generate that new bond. The oxygen remains. And the bromide now leaves with a negative charge and the four pairs of electrons. So it had three. Just to be clear how many electrons that bromide had, and it took the electrons with it as the leaving group. And so in this case, the bromide is acting as a leaving group. So a bond breaking process. Another extremely common mechanistic step is proton transfer. In proton transfer, we can see the transfer of a proton in many different steps. These are acid-base steps for the most part. They can be at the beginning of a reaction mechanism. They can be in the middle of a reaction mechanism. We see them happen all over the place. I'm going to switch to my fast switching here. This will make it easier to switch back and forth rather than going through the menu. So there we go. We take the electrons. The oxygen had a single pair of electrons and a positive charge. The electrons were used from the carbonyl to take the proton, and the electrons are kicked back to the oxygen. We end up with a protonated carbonyl and a water molecule. Another example, we could have acetone, and the proton that is on the acetone. We could have something take that proton, a base, maybe hydroxide ion. I'm trying to show all the electrons, all the lone pairs in these cases, although typically I don't. When I'm doing these reaction mechanisms in class or for myself, I oftentimes don't show the lone pairs. But I figure since these are our first time looking at these steps, that seeing the lone pairs can be helpful in actually tracking and seeing what's going on so that you understand what the arrows actually mean. So there's the result of that thing taking the proton, hydroxide ion taking the proton to form water. Okay, another example could be that we have something a little bit more complicated, perhaps something attached to a phosphorus. The phosphorus here has a positive charge, and the protons that we're interested in are in between the carbonyl and the phosphorus. And again, let's use hydroxide ion. We take the proton, the electrons break off of here and kick in to make a double bond with the phosphorus. Phosphorus is a period three element that can take on more than an octet. And so in this case, what we wind up making is a double bond to the phosphorus. The phosphorus now has five bonds, but that makes the phosphorus neutral. And the hydroxide has picked up the proton, and that has turned it into water. And the phosphorus no longer has a positive charge on it. So in this case, we get charge neutralization in the reaction between the acid and the base. So all of these different things are just proton transfers, the moving of a proton from one location to the next, acid-base steps. All right, next up, we have rearrangements. In rearrangements, we're looking at either the shift of a carbon or the shift of a proton, shift of atom connectivity that rearranges the framework. These are a little bit more difficult to spot. So here in this case, let's take a proton and we will look at the shifting of that proton from one location to the next. In this case, the proton actually shifts location. This results in the proton being attached to the new location. And what results on the other side is now something which is trigonal planar and a shifting of the carbocation. This is called a 1-2 hydride shift. The reason for it is it's switching from position one to position two. 1-2 hydride shift. We can look at a similar thing happening within a carbon framework where we can have a carbocation, a positive charge, and we can have a shifting of the alkyl group, where the alkyl group actually shifts. Once that alkyl group shifts, that allows for resonance and is the reason that the alkyl group actually shifts, because we get a resonance stabilized carbocation, which is more stable than the initial carbocation that started with. So this is a 1-2 alkyl shift. Again, similar sort of numbering, 1, 2, switching positions. Next up, we can have alkyl shifts that look a little bit different, a little harder to capture. Put this group up. And let's go ahead and put a positive charge out here. And we'll look at the shift that occurs this way, where this bond breaks and the group shifts to that carbocation. This one is a harder one to see and is a harder one to track. So in order to understand what's going on here, let's start by numbering all the carbons. And let's go through and number this number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. What's going to happen here when I shift this bond is the bond between 3 and 7 is going to break. In doing so, when it breaks, 7 is going to reconnect to 2. So what I'm going to do is, as a transitional step in drawing it, I'm going to draw the whole molecule. I'm going to reconnect this side a little bit different. Apologize for the dog who's barking. So let me renumber them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. The bond is going to be reconnecting from the bond that was 3 to the bond that is now to 2. So this bond is shifting over this way. I'm going to draw this as sort of an intermediate step so that you can see what's happening. And then I'm going to draw one more intermediate step, and then I'll draw the final product. So intermediate stepwise, I'm getting a new bond that is drawn here. And I will renumber them again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. So 7 is now connected to 2. And if I take a look at what that is, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's that bond. So this bond is a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sided molecule now. And so I will draw it as such. And then I will put that new bond in it and I will renumber them again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And 7. 7 is clearly connected to 2. 7 is connected to 2. Carbon number 1 comes off of 2. That is the new molecule. That is also a 1-2 alkyl shift. So these are examples of rearrangements. There are other types of rearrangements that we can typically see as well. They come up in certain types of chemical reactions where the bonds can all shift around. And once we shift all of those bonds around, if we go through and number them to track them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. This is a ring closing type reaction. I get a double bond between 2 and 3, a double bond between 4 and 5, and 6 and 1 get the single bond. This is a cyclorearrangement. I believe this one is called a sigmatrophic rearrangement. So these are kind of fun reactions to do. All right, combining patterns. What happens when we combine many of these different patterns? So combining patterns for chemical reactions. All right, let's take a look at what we can do here. We can have an alcohol. Reacting with an acid. We'll move to the protonated alcohol, the oxonium ion. Notice that I'm not drawing the lone pairs now because it takes too much time to actually go through and draw all the lone pairs. If we were going to try to do that, it's rather complicated. The water molecule leaves. Also notice that I'm dropping things off, right? That I ignored the bromide because the bromide is really not part of what I need to do next. So when the bromide is part of the product and I'm looking at the reactions as a sequence of steps, I oftentimes drop those things off. Like I would have dropped the water molecule off here and I would not have necessarily shown the water molecule. We can have the movement of a carbon so that we get a rearrangement that's sitting there. Now the bromide, which I didn't show before, can come back in, step in and bond. And now we can go back and we can put names to each one of these steps. And there would be the final product. So the first step would be a protonation step. Second step is loss of leaving group. Next step is a 1-2 alkyl shift. Nucleophilic attack. And then we finally get to the final product. So usually what I do, while I've put the name underneath the drawing, it's really the step that obtains the name. So really protonation is really the arrow and the movement of one step to the next. So we have the protonation step. We have the protonation step. We have the loss of leaving group. We have the alkyl shift. We have the nucleophilic attack and then the final product. So there's a bunch of steps. Sometimes these can get fairly complicated. Let's look at another sequence. Let me draw it in. And then let's see if we can find the arrows and where the arrows go. So this is going to be a step where I'm looking at curved arrows and how to apply the arrows in a sequence of steps. Let me draw the steps first. This will take a minute to go through and draw these guys. And sometimes the reaction mechanisms are complicated. A double bond there. A proton is here. And let me slide this over just a little bit. Let's pick this up with a base. We use hydroxide. We'll go to the anion, which sits here. It's got a double bond in it. this will be attacking an aldehyde. We'll pick it up with the next picture. Double bond at the wrong spot. Or do I? No, I have the double bond in the right spot. I have the double bond in the wrong spot on this image. On this image. Nope, that one's good. That's where the double bond goes. Okay, much better. This now has that attached to it. Notice that except for my first turn, where I turned things a little bit, I'm going to try not to turn things. I'm going to try to keep things as consistent as I can. I also missed, I'm missing all kinds of things. We'll get this right. Then we'll go back and we'll put the arrows to everything. I was missing my positive charge all the way throughout that. This next step got the proton on that guy. And the base. This is much easier to do when you're filling in the arrows as you go. It's much harder to do to go back and to try to draw it first without the arrows. It's excruciating to draw without the arrows. My brain really doesn't want to do it. But we need the images in order to be able to test us in drawing the, putting the arrows in. That is all correct there. This guy is going to be reacting with another equivalent of that aldehyde. I'm going to take this onto the next page. So I'm going to swing it down this way. And my next image is where I try to keep everything lined up exactly the same way that I had it. That comes back. New bond there. Sometimes it's easier to do these by using some color as well in order to track the new bonds and know where things go. All right, this is going to be a step where I'm going to need some acid over here. And we're almost done. I got two more steps and then we finish this thing up. Last part. Not that I'm trying to make this overly complicated, but most of the reaction mechanisms that we looked at are fairly complicated. And in this case, what I need is that base to come back in. And the last step in this, I'll slide these all over so I can keep this on one last line here, is where I create this product. And this guy is a catalyst which recycles itself. Okay, that's all the steps. Let's go back and put the arrows to it. So in order to look at this, what we need to do is we need to see what changed from the first part to the second part in order to figure out where the arrows go. Part of what's missing and part of what might be helpful is to be able to see what happened to each species. All right, this proton is missing and there's a negative charge that's there. And this hydroxyl group, the OH minus, has now turned into a water molecule and has picked up the proton. So if I do one little thing here, it may help to see what's happened. This was a proton transfer. That proton transfer means that the negative charge took the proton and the arrow returns the electrons to the carbon. And so that was a protonation step or deprotonation step. It's a proton transfer step, let's call it that. After the proton transfer, we now look at the next two steps and we decide what happened. There is a new bond that has been formed. This bond is a new bond. And the negative charge is now gone. And this carbon has become tetrahedral. And the oxygen has gathered a negative charge on it. So the reaction that has happened here is one where the negative charge has attacked the carbon. The bond is broken and the electrons have shifted onto the oxygen. And that's the arrow that relates that. This is a step that is a nucleophilic attack step. That nucleophilic attack, this ring is acting as the nucleophile and that guy is reacting as the electrophile. Okay, in the next step, again, we have to look at what has actually happened. We have a water molecule, and that water molecule has given up a proton and become a hydroxide. And this O minus, this alkoxide, has picked up the proton. So really what's happening in this one is that if we look at the if we look at the proton here, it is transferred to that position. So to make that happen, we will do a curved arrow representing the transfer of the electrons taking the proton, and then a curved arrow here from the bond to the oxygen itself. And that is another proton transfer step. Once we do that proton transfer, we look at the next sequence here that's happening. I'm going to add in what actually occurred and what's missing. And that is that this proton is now attached to that water molecule. This is again a proton transfer step. And the hydroxyl group is acting as a base, taking the proton. The electrons here are breaking. And, oh, we have to see what else has happened. There's another other thing that has happened here. I've got a double bond and a single bond. And this double bond is missing. And I now no longer have the positive charge. So all of that needs to take place. And that means that these electrons are going to push in to make a double bond. And these electrons are going to push onto that nitrogen to make a lone pair. Now, to highlight that, I'm going to do it this way. There's the lone pair that has showed up on the nitrogen, which has relieved the positive charge. And so I have had a sequence of things happen where I've created a new bond and I've added a lone pair onto the nitrogen in that sequence of steps. So what is that? That's really a proton transfer. is all that is. But that proton transfer has gone along with some bonds moving around as well. So it's not really a rearrangement because I have no new connectivities. The connectivity has stayed the same. There's been no loss of leaving group. There's been no hydride transfer. There's been no alkyl shift. All that's happened is the bonds have rearranged almost like resonance in the way that the bonds have moved around. Okay, in my next step, it looks like I'm going to be making a new bond that is going to be this bond here. And I am going to be breaking the carbon-oxygen bond. That's going to go to a single bond. And it looks like I get my double bond back and the positive charge comes back. So this step, what's going to happen is the lone pair of the nitrogen is going to push in to remake the double bond. This bond is going to break, and this bond is going to reach out and make a new bond with the carbon that's there. I'm going to redraw that arrow a little bit better, make it a curved arrow. This bond is going to break, and these electrons are going to shift up onto the oxygen in order to make the O minus. So that gives me back the double bond between the nitrogen and the carbon. That's with that first arrow. That's that double bond. This double bond breaks and is used to make the new bond. There's the new bond. This bond breaks between the oxygen and carbon, shifts up onto the oxygen. That gives me the oxygen with the negative charge on it. So there is all of that. In the next step, I didn't put a name to that. I should go and put a name to that. In the next step, it looks like we're going to have a proton transfer. We need to put a name to this one. So what would I call this overall thing? This I would actually call a nucleophilic attack. This is the nucleophile. It is attacking the carbonyl, making a new bond. So this is a nucleophilic attack step. This is my nucleophile. And this one's my electrophile. Okay, this one's a little bit easier. This one's a proton transfer. And then this last step is a little bit more difficult. This last step, what I'm doing is I'm breaking this bond here. Notice that the bond is going away. This whole group is breaking off from the rest of the molecule. And looks like I did miss one step. I got one more step that I got to put in here. This should have had a positive charge on it. We'll catch that next step in a second. So the way that this works is the electrons from this oxygen push in to make a double bond. This bond breaks. They leave with that group. This is loss of leaving group. This is the leaving group that is coming off. Now, hard to pick it up here. I'll use LG for leaving group, that group is coming off and breaking. And as it does so, it creates the anion that leaves here. And this thing, which is now got a double bond and the proton on it, which is protonated. So this is loss of leaving group. And finally, I'll do one last step here. I will use that hydroxide that I've been fond of. The hydroxide is going to come back and it's going to take that proton. I will have water that I form, and I'll leave this guy over here, even though it's not participating in this step. And so arrow-wise, anion takes proton, return electrons to the carbonyl. And that was a proton transfer again. The reaction mechanism is complete. So you can see, I'll back up, that the curved arrows are essential to really understanding what's happening in each step. Without the curved arrows, if you just look at the reaction mechanism without the curved arrows, it's very difficult to follow. The arrows actually significantly help in showing what is happening in each step and the movement from one to the next, which also helps in our identification of what the step actually is. So the arrows are really critical to understanding the reaction mechanism. Okay, let me pick it up from here. The next thing in this chapter goes into, I think it's 6.11. So chapter 6, section 11. This section is on carbocation rearrangement. I'm going to actually hold on this. This is a topic that we pick up a little bit later. We come back in chapter 7 when we start looking at SN1 reactions. And I'm going to save this for chapter 7. We'll look at it in context. With the SN1 reactions. It'll make more sense at that time. It's not an easy thing to look at outside of context. Just looking at the carbocation rearrangements for the sake of carbocations doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But looking at it in terms of a chemical reaction where the product rearranges and the reasons why it rearranges makes a lot more sense. So hold on 6.11 in the carbocation rearrangement. We'll come back in chapter 7. We'll pick it up there. Let's move on to reversible versus irreversible steps. And we'll look at some more mechanistic steps that are in here, and we'll finish this out. So this is the last part that we'll look at. We should be able to finish chapter 6 today. And on Thursday, we'll pick up with chapter 7. So the next thing I want to look at is reversible versus irreversible. Many steps within organic chemistry are considered to be reversible. Many are considered to be irreversible. How do I know which ones are which, or what am I looking for? What is it that makes something reversible? What is it that makes something irreversible? It's not a super easy topic. Let's look at a couple of things. Let's look at a carbocation reacting with a water molecule. In this case, this is a nucleophilic attack where the water molecule attacks the carbocation to make a new bond. In making that new bond, the carbon becomes tetrahedral, and the hydroxyl group, now with three bonds to it, picks up the positive charge. This water molecule that is attached to this carbon is actually a really good leaving group. This bond is not a strong bond. And the fact that the oxygen has a positive charge makes this thing rather unstable. And being rather unstable, this is actually a good leaving group, which can come back off and can pop off. And as such, popping off, let's do it this way. makes for a rather reversible reaction. If I think about this as the forwards direction, and I think about this one as the reverse direction, this is a fairly reversible reaction. And it's reversible because of the fact that this group is a rather good leaving group. And the fact that it's a good leaving group means that it comes off fairly easily and that this reaction is reversible. That reversibility is tied to the idea that this is a good leaving group. And it's this component right here that makes the reaction reversible. Let's compare that to another reaction where I may have a carbanion attacking a carbonyl, making a new carbon-carbon bond. And this guy kicking up to become a negative charge. In this case, the reaction moves forward. The carbon, let's do it this way. I want to make that my single bond. Let's make these two carbons. Let's make that the backward one, the forward one. And this is the anion. And this is the CH3, which came in and made the new bond. This group is a rather poor leaving group. These are ideas that we're going to have to study to understand what makes something a good leaving group and what makes something a poor leaving group. Essentially, it's about how the group comes off and what the group looks like. One way that I could say it is that a water molecule, when it comes off, this is the group that left. This is very stable as a neutral molecule. And as such, is low energy for it to come off and makes for a good leaving group. This thing, the CH3 minus, is very unstable. It's extremely reactive. Carbons don't like to have a negative charge on them as a anion like that. And as such, it's a very poor leaving group, which makes it not wanting to come off. That makes this reaction not reversible. So sometimes the reversibility has to do with the stability of one side of the reaction versus the other side of the reaction. We can see that in a couple of other instances. I can show another reversible reaction, another good leaving group. We can counter this with a leaving group that is a halogen, maybe a bromide, where this group comes off. This group in coming off, I'll do it this way. This is the forwards reaction going towards the carbocation and the bromide. This would be the reverse reaction where the bromide comes in and attacks. And that would be the reversible component. The bromide here is a very stable leaving group. And yet when the bond is made, it's all neutral and there's no positive or negative charges. This is another example of something that is reversible. It's reversible in the sense that the bromide is a fairly stable leaving group. The carbocation that is formed is a tertiary carbocation, which makes the carbocation very stable. And yet on the other side, it's also very stable to have the bromide attached to the carbon and to have everything neutral. That makes it very stable as well. Another example of things that are reversible versus irreversible, let's take a look at a carbanion taking a proton from a water molecule. We can look at this and we can examine the acidity, the pKa of the water molecule, which is about 15.7. we can look at the products that are formed out of this. And we end up with hydroxide ion and butane. And that butane has a pKa that is close to 50. And given the differences in the pKa values, pKa being 15, this is a very, very weak acid. This is a relatively strong acid. I say relatively because when I look at a pKa 50 and a pKa of 15.7 on a pKa scale, which is logarithmic, I usually don't think of water as a strong acid, but in this case, when I have something that has a pKa of 50, relative to that very, very, very weak acid, water is a relatively strong acid. Given the differences in the pKa values, this is a non-reversible reaction. Because of the pKa difference being so great, I can counter that. I can look at an alcohol. Actually, let's not make that an alcohol yet. Let's make that an alkoxide ion. I could look at tertiary butoxide here and reacting with water. As we said before, the pKa for water equals 15.7. I could look at this alkoxide taking the proton and creating tertiary butanol and hydroxide ion. The pKa on the alcohol now is about 18. Now the pKas are very similar. In that the pKas are similar, this reaction is rather reversible. So a couple of different ways to look at reversible versus irreversible. We can look at it in terms of leaving groups and how stable the leaving groups are. We can look at it in terms of acids and bases and the relative similarity versus difference of their pKa values. So those are a couple of different ways that we can look at these. Oh, I didn't draw the arrows on the one here taking the proton. So we should get those arrows in there. So what we're doing there is we're using an arrow that is a single arrow that means non-reversible. And we're using an arrow which is an equilibrium arrow to mean reversible. So these are equilibrium arrows. Versus a reaction arrow. So a difference in the types of arrows that we're using. I had a few more examples here of things. Let me draw two more, I guess. This one is a carboxylic acid reacting with hydroxide, the reaction of an acid and a base. Here, the pKa is equal to 4.8. And we have the hydroxide ion, which is taking the proton, giving the electrons back to the oxygen. In this sense, we generate a carboxylate and a water molecule. The water molecule has pKa that is about 15.7. So the pKa difference here, not as large as what we had seen before, but large enough to say that this is not an equilibrium, that this is a reaction that goes mostly in the forwards direction. And so we would say that this is mostly not reversible. in the sense that we're reacting with hydroxide. This is not reacting with water. This is reacting with hydroxide ion rather than water. And so this is a strong, strong base. And as such, that strong base converts into a weak acid. So that would be not reversible. Another common thing that we see for reactions being not reversible is where the reaction proceeds and the leaving group is eliminated in one of two ways. If the leaving group is eliminated such that, in this case, if I take the proton, the electrons kick in, the electrons push out, this thing breaks down and becomes nitrogen gas, a water molecule, and a carbanion. Because this thing here is a gas, and that gas leaves the reaction vessel, it was lone pairs that were on those nitrogens. Because that gas leaves the reaction vessel, it's a non-reversible reaction. When you have something that either leaves as a gas or precipitates out as a solid, those reactions are non-reversible because a component is eliminated. And by Le Chatelier's principle, the reaction moves forward and there is no equilibrium. So this is non-reversible. When a product is eliminated, either by leaving as a gas, let's say it's leaving the reaction entirely, leaving the reaction as a gas, or precipitating out. As a solid, then the reaction is non-reversible. So those are the other two things. So I usually do it this way. I show a gas going up, or I show a precipitate, PPT. Or sometimes I'll write solid, precipitating out, going down. So gases are going out, solids are going down. Those things make for non-reversible chemical reactions. All right. Chapter 7 is where we start picking up with alkyl halides and alcohols, and looking at a series of reactions. We start with substitution reactions in chapter 7. So we look at alkyl halides. Alkyl halides are things that have X where X equals bromide, chloride, iodide, generally not fluoride. Fluoride is a halide. You put a fluoride in it, it is an alkyl halide, that's true. However, fluorides are typically fairly unreactive, and so we don't spend a whole lot of time looking at fluorides. So generally we think about alkyl halides as bromides, chlorides, iodides. We'll throw fluoride in there too, but fluoride is a little bit off topic. We also look at alcohols. We'll spend a little bit of time. We'll go over their nomenclature. And substitution reactions. So those substitution reactions tend to be a big part of it. Substitution, both by what we call SN1 and SN2. These are substitution nucleophilic first order and second order. So we'll look at these first order reactions and second order reactions. And this is where things start to get more complicated. We've spent a lot of time now looking at all of the different things that relate to stability for organic molecules. We've spent a lot of time looking at the molecules themselves, being able to draw them in bond line formulas. We've spent time looking at Newman projections, sterics, electronics, resonance. We've looked at all of these different factors. Now we're going to start putting all of those different factors together to look at some of our first chemical reactions, the substitution nucleophilic first order and second order reactions. After we finish the substitution reactions in chapter 8, we go into the elimination reactions, and we look at elimination first order and elimination second order reactions. And then we put them all together, and we do a chapter where we look at substitution and elimination reactions for first and second order, and we start predicting. So these first two chapters, chapter 7 and chapter 8, are where we learn about the reactions, and we ask you to predict, given a reaction mechanism, we tell you what the mechanism is going to be, you give us the product. When we get to chapter 9, we start looking at all four of these reactions, and we give you the reaction, and we don't tell you what the reaction mechanism is, and we ask you to discover the reaction mechanism and predict the product. That is a much harder skill set. That is where people really start to stumble. This is the first really challenging part of organic chemistry. Not that this is the most difficult by any means. There are far more difficult components that we will cover in second semester of organic chemistry. However, if you can make it through this section and you can understand SN1, SN2, E1, E2, and the next three chapters that we go through, then all of the other stuff, as challenging as it gets, even as it gets more challenging than this, you can handle it. It's really about this material, and this material that becomes extraordinarily challenging. So we've got some significant challenges coming up in the next few lectures as we go through these substitution nucleophilic reactions. However, like I said, it really doesn't pick up until we start putting them all together. And then we have something like 5-6 different variables that determine which of the four reactions takes place. And those variables don't have a hierarchy. The hierarchy changes, and sometimes some things are more important, other times other things are more important. And you need to learn what to pay attention to and what to ignore under different circumstances. So lots of things to come here. I think I'm going to cut it there, and I'll pick up with this lecture in chapter 7, and we'll look at nomenclature first, and then we'll very quickly get into the substitution nucleophilic reactions, and we'll do that on Thursday. All right. I'm going to cut it there. That's it for today. I'll see you guys tomorrow for lab, and back on Thursday for lecture. All right. Take care, everyone.